Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. So I'd like to review a little bit. Last week we ended with how Abraham Lincoln was faring in this whole process with the banks. The Confederacy was not the only power that was bent on destroying Lincoln's Union government, which we had studied as kids in school, and it wasn't just about slavery. Lurking behind the curtain pulling the strings of war were powerful foreign financiers. Otto von Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany in the second half of the 19th century, called these puppeteers the masters of European finance. He said in a quote, "I know of absolute certainty that the division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained in one block and as one nation, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over Europe and the world. Of course, in the inner circle of finance, the voice of the Rothschilds prevailed. They saw an opportunity for prodigious booty if they could substitute two feeble democracies burdened with debt to the financiers in place of a vigorous republic sufficient unto herself. Therefore, they sent their emissaries into the field to exploit the question of slavery and to drive a wedge between the two parts of the Union. The rupture between the North and the South became inevitable. The masters of European finance employed all their forces to bring it about and to turn it to their advantage. That's the end of that quote. The European bankers wanted a war that would return the United States to its colonial state, to its colonial status, but they were not necessarily interested in preserving slavery. Slavery just meant that the owners had to feed and care for the workers. The bankers preferred the European plan. Capital could exploit labor by controlling the money supply while letting the laborers feed themselves. In July 1862, this ploy was revealed in a notorious document called the Hazard Circular, which was reported to have been circulated by British banking interests among the American banking counterparts. The circular said, "Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery destroyed. This I and my European friends are glad of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers, while the European plan, led by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the war must be used as a means to control the volume of money. To accomplish this, the bonds must be used as a banking basis. It will not do to allow the greenback, as it is called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that." End of the quote. The system the bankers wanted to preserve was what Henry Clay and Henry Carey had called the British system, with its twin weapons of free trade and the gold standard, keeping the less industrialized countries in a colonial state, supplying raw materials to Britain's factories. The American South had already been subjugated in this way, and the bankers had now set their sights on the North to be reeled in with usurious war loans, but Lincoln had refused to take the bait. The threat the new greenback system posed to the bankers' game was reflected in an editorial that is of uncertain origin, but was reportedly published in the London Times in 1865. It warned, quote, "If that mischievous financial policy, which had its origin in the North American Republic, should become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without a debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in the history of the civilized governments of the world. The brains and the wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." End of quote. Bismarck is quoted as stating in 1876, quote, "The government and the nation escaped the plots of the foreign financiers. They understood at once that the United States would escape their grip. The death of Lincoln was resolved upon." Lincoln was assassinated in 1865. And the position here is that assassination was caused by the bankers. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Well, what we see historically is that the European financiers had failed to trap Lincoln's government with usurious war loans, but they achieved their ends by other means. While one faction in Congress was busy getting the greenbacks issued to fund the war, another faction was preparing a national banking act that would deliver a monopoly over the power to create the nation's money supply to the Wall Street bankers and their European affiliates. the National Banking Act was promoted as establishing safeguards for the new national banking system. But while it was an important first step toward a truly national bank, it was only a compromise with the bankers, and buried in the fine print, it gave them exactly what they wanted. A private communication from a Rothschild investment house in London to an associate banking firm in New York dated June 25, 1863, confided, quote, "The few who understand the system will either be so interested in its profits or so dependent upon its favors that there will be no opposition from that class, while, on the other hand, the great body of people, mentally incapable of comprehending, will bear its burdens without complaint." End of quote. The act looked good on its face. It established a comptroller of the currency whose authority was required before a national banking association could start business. It laid down regulations covering minimum capitalization, reserve requirements, bad debts, and reporting. The comptroller could at any time appoint investigators to look into the affairs of any national bank. Every bank director had to be an American citizen, and three-quarters of the directors of a bank had to be residents of the state in which the bank did business. Interest rates were limited by state usury laws, and if no laws were in effect, then to 7%. Banks could not hold real estate for more than 5 years, except for bank buildings. National banks were not allowed to circulate notes they printed themselves. Instead, they had to deposit U.S. bonds with the Treasury in a sum equal to at least one-third of their capital. They got government-printed notes in return. So, what was the problem? Although the new national banknotes were technically issued by the controller of currency, this was just a formality, like the printing of the Federal Reserve notes by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing today. The currency bore the name of the bank posting the bond, and it was issued at the bank's request. In effect, the National Banking Act authorized the bankers to issue and lend their own paper money. The banks deposited bonds with the Treasury, but they still owned the bonds, and they immediately got their money back in the form of their own banknotes. Topping it off, the National Banking Act effectively removed the competition to these banknotes. It imposed a heavy tax on the notes of the state-chartered banks, essentially abolishing them. It also curtailed competition from the greenbacks, which were limited to specific issues, while the bankers' notes could be issued at will. Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase and others complained that the bankers were buying up the greenbacks with their own banknotes. Zerlenga cites a historian named Dewey, who wrote in 1903, quote, "The banks were accused of absorbing the government's notes as fast as they were issued and of putting out their own notes in substitution and then at their own convenience converting the notes into bonds on which they earned interest in gold." End of quote. The government got what it needed at the time, a loan of substantial sums for the war effort and a sound circulating currency for an expanding economy. But the banks were the real winners. They not only got to collect interest on money of which they still had the use, but they got powerful leverage over the government as its creditors. The act that was supposed to regulate the bankers wound up chartering not one, but a whole series of private banks, which all had the power to create currency of the nation. The National Banking Act was recommended to Congress by Treasury Secretary Chase, ironically the same official who had sponsored the Greenback Program the Act effectively eliminated. In a popular 1887 book called Seven Financial Conspiracies That Have Enslaved the American People, Sarah Emery wrote that Chase acquiesced only after several days of meetings and threats of financial coercion by bank delegates. He is quoted as saying later, "My agency is procuring the passage of the National Bank Act was the greatest financial mistake of my life. It has built up a monopoly that affects every interest in the country. It should be repealed. But before this can be accomplished, the people will be arrayed on one side and the banks on the other in a contest such as we have never seen in this country." End of quote. Although President Lincoln was assassinated in 1865, it would be another 50 years before the promise of the debt-free greenbacks were erased from the minds of a people long suspicious of the usury bankers and their gilded paper money. The Gilded Age, the period between the Civil War and World War I, was a series of battles over who should issue the country's currency and what it should consist of. Chase appeared on the scene again in 1869, this time as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He wrote the opinion in Hepburn v. Griswold, holding the Legal Tender Acts to be unconstitutional. Chase considered the greenbacks to be a temporary war measure. He wrote that the Constitution prohibits the states from passing any law impairing the obligation of contracts, and that to compel holders of contracts calling for payment in gold and silver to accept payment in mere promises to pay dollars was an unconstitutional deprivation of property without due process of law. In 1871, however, with two new justices on the bench, the Supreme Court reversed and found that the Legal Tender Acts were constitutional. In the Legal Tender cases, Knox v. Lee and Juilliard v. Greenman, the court declared that Congress has the power to coin money and regulate its value, with the objects of self-preservation and the achievement of a more perfect union, and that no obligation of contract can extend to the defeat of the legitimate government authority. In 1873, an act the populists would call the Crime of 73 eliminated the free coinage of silver. Like when King George banned the use of locally issued paper scrip a century earlier, the result was tight money and hard times. A bank panic followed, which hit the Western debtor farmers particularly hard. In 1874, the politically powerful farmers responded by forming the Greenback Party. Their proposed solution to the crisis was for the government to finance the building of roads and public projects with additional debt-free greenbacks, augmenting the money supply and putting the unemployed to work, returning the country to the sort of full employment and productivity seen in Benjamin Franklin's time. The greenbacks could also be used to redeem the federal debt. Under the Ohio idea, all government bonds, not specifying payment in gold or silver, would be repaid in greenbacks. The plan was not adopted, but the scarecrow had shown he had a brain. The timid lion had demonstrated the courage and the collective will to organize and make a difference. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In 1875, a resumption act called for redemption by the Treasury of all greenbacks in specie. The greenbacks had to be withdrawn and replaced with hard currency, producing further contraction of the money supply and deeper depression. In 1878, the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman joined forces to form the Greenback Labor Party. They polled over 1 million votes and elected 14 representatives to Congress. They failed to get a new issue of greenbacks, but they had enough political clout to stop further withdrawal of existing greenbacks from circulation. The greenbacks then outstanding, $346 million worth, were made a permanent part of the nation's currency. Meanwhile, depression deepened, leaving masses of unemployed to face poverty and starvation at a time when there was no Social Security system or unemployment insurance to act as a safety net. Produce was left to rot in the fields because there was no money to pay workers to harvest it or to buy it when it got to the market. The country was facing poverty amidst plenty because there was insufficient money in circulation to keep the wheels of trade turning. The country sorely needed the sort of liquidity urged by Lincoln, Carey, and the Greenbackers, but the bankers insisted that allowing the government to print its own money would be dangerously inflationary. That was their argument, but critics called it humbuggery. Humbug is a word that isn't used much today, but in the Gilded Age, it was a popular term for describing frauds, shams, and con artists. Vernon Parrington, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian writing in the 1920s, used it to describe the arguments of the bankers to silence the farmers who were trying to reform the banker-controlled money system in the 1890s. It was the farmers who particularly felt the pinch of tight money when the bankers withheld their gold. Parrington wrote that the farmers pitted their homespun experience against the authority of the bankers and the teaching of the schools. In response to their clear-headed arguments, the bankers defended with a smokescreen of confusing rhetoric. Quote, denunciation took the place of exposition and hysteria of argument, and in this revel of demagoguery, the so-called educated classes, lawyers and editors and businessmen, were perhaps the most shameless purveyors of humbuggery. Stripped of all hypocrisy, the main issue was this. Should the control of currency issues, with the delegated power of inflation and deflation, lie in the hands of private citizens or with elected representatives of the people? But throughout the years, when the subject was debated in every newspaper and on every stump, the real issue was rarely presented for consideration. The bankers did not dare to present it, for too much was at stake, and once it was clearly understood by a suspicious electorate, their case was lost. Hence, the strategy of the money group was to obscure the issue, an end they achieved by dwelling on the single point of inflation. That's the end of the quote. It's a real educational point that the parallels between what was happening over a century ago is precisely what is happening today in how these issues are couched and spun by the powers that control. So let's look at the gold standard and the inflation argument. They were used to justify the banker's position and were based on the classical quantity theory of money. The foundation of classical monetary theory is held that inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods. When demand, that's the money available to buy goods, increases faster than supply, those are the goods and services, prices are forced up. If the government were allowed to simply issue all the greenback dollars it needed, the money supply would increase faster than the goods and services, and price inflation would result. If paper money were tied to gold, a commodity in limited and fixed supply, the money supply would remain stable, and price inflation would be avoided. And that's the theory. A corollary to that theory was the classical maxim that the government should balance its budget at all costs. If it ran short of money, it was supposed to borrow from the bankers rather than print the money it needed in order to keep from inflating the money supply. The argument was a straw man argument, one easily knocked down because it contained a logical fallacy. But the fallacy was not immediately obvious because the bankers were concealing their hand. The fallacy lay in the assumption that the money the government borrowed from the banks already existed and was merely being recycled. If the bankers themselves were creating the money they lent, the argument collapsed in a heap of straw. The money supply would obviously increase just as much from bank-created money as from government-created money. In either case, it was money pulled out of an empty hat. Money created by the government had the advantage, however, that it would not plunge the taxpayers into debt, and it provided a permanent money supply, one not dependent on higher and higher levels of borrowing to stay afloat. This is almost kindergarten economics that, if the masses of the people were to really understand it, which really means we're exposed to this notion because it's not hard to understand, outcomes like we saw in the movie Inside Job would not result today, and the central banking concept would fall away very rapidly, giving the masses of people the fair opportunity to regain control of their financial lives. But further looking at the quantity theory of money, it actually contained another logical fallacy, which was pointed out later by British economist John Maynard Keynes. Adding money, demand, to the economy would drive up prices only if the supply side of the equation remained fixed. If new greenbacks were used to create new goods and services, supply would increase along with demand and prices would remain stable. When a shoe salesman with many unsold shoes on his shelves suddenly got more customers, he did not raise his prices. He sold more shoes. If he ran out of shoes, he ordered more from the factory, which produced more. If he were to raise his prices, his customers would go to the shop down the street where shoes were still being sold at the lower price. Adding more money to the economy would inflate prices only when the producers ran out of the labor and materials needed to make more goods. Before that, however, supply and demand would increase together, leaving prices as they were before. So, for example, the theoretical revision really helps to explain paradoxical data as the economic mystery of China. The Chinese have managed to keep the prices of their products low for thousands of years, although their money supply has continually been flooded with the world's gold and silver, and now with the world's dollars, as those currencies have poured in to pay for China's cheap products. The Keynesian explanation is that prices have remained stable because the money has gone into producing more goods, increasing supply with the demand. They can and do produce more. In February of 2006, Keith Bradshaw of the New York Times observed, quote, "A long-standing mystery for economic historians lies in how so much gold and silver flowed to China for centuries for the purchase of Chinese goods, yet caused little inflation in China. Many of China's manufactured goods remained cheaper than other countries' manufactured goods until the early 1800s, despite the rapidly growing supply of silver sloshing around the Chinese economy. One theory is that Chinese output was expanding as fast as the precious metal supply. The same phenomenon has appeared today, as dollars inundating China have resulted in practically no increase in prices for most goods and services, although real estate prices have jumped in most cities." End of quote. And we will continue this investigation next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.